This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. In Brussels today, officials formally identified the 32 victims of the brutal attacks there 8 days ago. 90 people now remain hospitalized. A third of them are suffering severe burns. Brussels joins a growing list of cities that have dealt with these type of attacks that have left many people hurt and maimed, and that's something Boston knows all too well after the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings. One question in the aftermath of Brussels: what lessons have been learned in terms of emergency medical preparedness? Well, with us in studio is someone who has experience with this and can help answer that question. Dr. Eric Guralnick is Medical Director of Emergency Preparedness for Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
So have you heard from anyone in Brussels about what it's like there on the ground?
We haven't heard much. We've seen some email traffic back and forth. Mm-hmm. And remarkably, it's very similar to what we were dealing with here in Boston shortly thereafter the event.
So what are you thinking when you see what's happening there, especially after what we experienced here in 2013?
Well, I'm sure they're going through a similar experience right after the event. Initially, dealing with a wave of casualties that you wouldn't normally expect to see during a day shift in an emergency department, the types of wounds you would see on the battlefield, and the aftermath. And really, when the marathon ended here for us, it really started to begin for us, and working with our patients, families, and staff, and helping them through the event afterwards.
What types of coordination is there with Boston and other cities, particularly international cities, maybe Brussels, regarding best emergency practices? I know we did a story about a year ago here in our newsroom, and we spoke with folks who said, you know, the Boston Marathon bombings and the response really are taught almost in various medical facilities around the world in terms of how to respond to a tragedy like that. Is that what's happening?
We do our best to share these experiences. They're rare events. Unfortunately, they're becoming more common. Mm. And we try to leverage as many forums as possible. We recently had a forum led by the Institute of Medicine at the end of February where we had responders from Boston, from San Bernardino, from France, that exchanged their experiences so we can learn from each other what we did well and where we could improve. Mm.
But every situation is so different, right? And that must make it so hard to prepare and to sort of draw lessons, right? So what would you say, if you could, are some of the main overriding themes that would be applicable to folks that you would, what advice do you give people, like people in Brussels?
What's fascinating is the lessons are strikingly similar.
Really?
The first is that exercises, drills, and training matter. We did 78 exercises the 5 years prior to the Boston Marathon bombing at Brigham and Women's. Our city, the city of Boston, public health, emergency medical services, law enforcement, government all work together and plan and drill every year to prepare for the marathon itself. And other cities drill and exercise in varied capacity. In fact, in Paris, they drilled that morning prior to the event, and they credit studying our response and that drill and helping them respond that day.
Hmm. And what would, aside from the drills and practicing, and this is what we do know that there were a few shortcomings in Boston, despite the fact that so many people survived. And one of the challenges that we heard about was communication. And how do you set up communication, and how do you deal with something like that? And how do you deal with lots of people trying to help, but having leadership and coordination of all of those people coming to area hospitals, all of the medical professionals coming to area hospitals to try to help? What would you say were some of the challenges, and how have those been worked out?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. Communication is always number one, two, and three. We think of communication both internally and externally. So internally, when you're getting, in our case, 40 victims or survivors that came into our hospital in a short amount of time, 23 in the first hour, communicating between various pods within an emergency department, and our response across various clinicians in an emergency department was challenging, so we had to rely on runners because our cell phones were down during that event. Right. And then externally, thinking about social media, We could look at people were tweeting, bystanders, and other individuals and providers were tweeting during the event. And so learning how do you disseminate fact from fiction during that event. And so we had a lot of information that was coming in from multiple sources trying to prepare and respond for not only those first two explosions, but potentially another explosion that occur and the response that we would need to mount.
Mm-hmm. I read that in Brussels in particular, there was a lot of criticism that some emergency medical vehicles had to be kept back just in case of other attacks like you're talking about. So you have to prepare because you don't know if it's over. You don't know if there will be more violence. And that was something that folks were, it was a really difficult decision, right? You don't send emergency medical teams somewhere because you may need them in case something larger happens somewhere else. And how do you train to make those kinds of decisions? I thought that was a very interesting component of the emergency medical response there.
It's a critical challenge. You think about Al-Qaeda operating and working on tertiary or quaternary IEDs or improvised explosive devices planted specifically for first responders. We've learned that quite a bit from Israel and their experience overseas with homicidal bombers in those cases. So we've tried to train for that. But as one of my colleagues in Boston EMS says, I see hurt people, I help hurt people. And he went in, like many others that day, to help individuals that were injured and get them back to the hospital as soon as possible.
What does the military teach civilian doctors about emergency response?
We've learned so much from the military in emergency medicine and emergency response. If you think about the history of medicine, many of the pioneers come from the military. And in fact, in this case, we think about interventions like tourniquets. And leaders like Frank Butler, a former SEAL who became a physician, and others led an effort to employ tourniquets in first responders, first in the military. And we've looked at this in the last 15 years being at war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and many of the injuries, in fact, 60% of the preventable deaths were due to bleeding extremities, legs, arms. So by simply applying a tourniquet, you could have a significant reduction in deaths. And so again, that has now transitioned into the civilian space. So leaders like Rich Serino, former director of Boston EMS, followed soon by Jim Hooley, they led training here
also
in Boston.
Boston EMS.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Boston EMS on tourniquet training. And we think that helped individuals. And that has been adapted in the civilian world by campaigns like Stop the Bleed, which is trying to educate not only first responders, but bystanders, just like you have a defibrillator at a stadium, having tourniquets so individuals can employ and use those in these types of events.
Another one of the challenges that we learned about after the marathon bombings was identifying patients and making sure that was done right away and obviously done properly. How has that been taken care of since, and how do you advise others about that?
The challenge, again, was having a mass of patients coming in a short time. We had 19 patients in the first half an hour, 23 in the first hour. And we have systems in place that can deal with 1, 2, 3 unidentified patients by using a string of numbers and an unidentified naming convention. And then soon after, when we do get a patient's name, either by finding a license on them or contacting a family member, we can then revise their name. But when you're in a mass casualty and you have 40 patients with a string of numbers, you can confuse one patient from the other, and you don't register them in a timely fashion, which also potentially could delay types of therapies that we rely on entering in an information system. Mm-hmm. So what we did shortly thereafter was revise our unidentified naming convention so it's much more streamlined and simple, and then had some meetings with national leaders in this workspace to sort of help move towards a national unidentified naming convention.
What's the number one thing you suggest to other cities? Is it communication?
Communication and drilling and exercising. Those drills and exercises build trust and relationships, so you don't wait till the actual event to meet people. You know them before, you know their strengths and weaknesses, and you trust each other.
All right. Dr. Eric Aralnik, Medical Director of Emergency Preparedness for Brigham and Women's Hospital, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.